So, to the fall of Syria and the ongoing situation in the Middle East, then there's Ukraine, Russia. To discuss this, we've invited Scott Horton, director of the Libertarian Institute. Their mission is to expose the corruption and abuses of the state, both foreign and domestic. He's editorial director of antiwar.com, host of Anti-War Radio in Los Angeles, and podcasts, The Scott Horton Show, from scotthorton.org. He's also the author of a number of books, the latest, most recent, Provoked, How Washington Started the New Cold War with Russia and the Catastrophe in Ukraine. Scott Horton, welcome to our radio station. Thanks for coming on.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Okay. I hope you don't mind the barrage of questions that will follow. Okay. So get ready. All right. So with what seemed to begin on October 7th, 23, is the Middle East, in your view, and this is how the Brits put it, about to kick off? That is, a fuse has been lit. Some kind of inevitable wider regional conflict is impending, or maybe not. What do you think?
Well, I am terribly worried about the near-term and medium-term future of Syria here. I mean, you have Israel carving out a big chunk. You have America already stationed with major forces in the east, ensconced, essentially protecting the Kurdish YPG forces, also known as the SDF. And then you have the Turks and their bin Ladenite forces in the middle that have now run rampage over the rest of the country, and including sacked the capital city. These guys literally are Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Syria. Their leader, Al-Jolani, I mean, you can't make this stuff up. He was inspired by the September 11th attacks to go and join the jihad, and then went and fought against Americans in Fallujah in Iraq War II. And then after Iraq War II was over and the Arab Spring kicked off and America and Saudi decided to hijack it in Syria, at the same time, the bin Ladenites went to hijack it. And this guy, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who later became the caliph of the Islamic State Caliphate, he sent Jolani, this guy's a Saudi, sent him into Syria to go and found Al-Qaeda in Iraq, in Syria, also known as Jabhat al-Nusra. And when Barack Obama, in concert with Netanyahu and Turkey's Erdogan and all the kings of the Gulf, when they backed this so-called revolution, what it really was is a foreign invasion by a bunch of jihadi marauders back 10 years ago, what happened, as your audience will probably recall, is that instead of going west and sacking Damascus like they were supposed to, they went the easier route. And in fact, it was really the Iraqi-dominated faction of Al-Qaeda in Iraq and Syria split off and said, you know what? We'll just conquer all of eastern Syria. And then a year later, that was in 13. And then a year later, they rolled in and they sacked Mosul instead of Damascus. They rolled in and conquered all of western Iraq and declared the caliphate, the ISIS Islamic State caliphate, the same guy Baghdadi up there on the balcony leading the thing. And that led to Iraq War III, where then Barack Obama went and allied with the Shiites in Iraq and Iran to destroy the caliphate again. And that led to, Donald Trump finished that war in his first term, in his first year in office, in fact, in his last time around in 2017. And then what happened after that was the bin Ladenites were essentially holed up in the Idlib province in northwestern Syria, and they were protected by Turkey, and America, including under the Trump administration, forbid the Syrian government from going in there and finally defeating them and cleaning them out, which they could have done with their help from Hezbollah and Iran and Russia at the time. But the politics, of course, in America were that Donald Trump is a pro-Russian spy, compromised, blackmailed traitor, and all of this total hoax. None of it was true, but it completely hemmed him in and prevented him from doing anything like... And I'm not saying he should have allied with these Shiite groups and Iran and Russia, but he could have just stayed out and let them finish off Al-Qaeda. And instead, you have America and our allies are on the side of the guys that knocked the towers down because they hate the Shiites more, mostly because that's what Israel wants. And the whole thing is a disaster. So now, here we are 10 years later. These guys, you mentioned October 7th. What happened here in Syria is sort of Syria's October 7th. They broke out of their little pen in the Idlib province, but they, instead of, in the analogy here, they sacked Tel Aviv. They made it to Damascus and took over the whole place, destroyed what was called Syria. So what's going to happen now? You know, the last time Obama had to go and bomb the caliphate right back off the face of the earth again. What's Donald Trump going to do? Donald Trump does, he really doesn't want to fight.
Well, Donald Trump has already stated that he'd destroyed ISIS, but obviously not that little bit of ISIS.
Right. So this was, yeah, ISIS had broken off. So this is still Al-Qaeda, loyal to the old ancient regime of Al-Qaeda leadership, whatever's left of it, and their agenda. And they're still there, and they have more power and influence than ever before. And, okay, picture the map of the Middle East in your head real quick. Go back 10 years when they created the caliphate. They were surrounded by enemies. They had Shiite Iraq. They had the Kurds. They had Jordan. And, you know, Saudi was their friends, but certainly wasn't going to let them cross the line into Arabia, right? So they were hemmed in. They were going to burn themselves out anyway. They were surrounded by enemies anyway. They had, and, of course, in Syria, they had the help of Hezbollah and Iran and Russia. But now we don't have that at all. Now the whole dynamic has changed. Now we have the caliphate just in what was recently called Syria, whatever they're going to call it now. And the Islamic Republic of Bin Laden-stan, and and they're surrounded by their friends. They have the Turks who support them in their north. They have the Israelis who support them in their south. They have the Americans who support them in the east. And who do they have in their west? They have Hezbollah, who, if they're lucky, can keep them out, but certainly are no offensive force to destroy them. Russia is busy in Ukraine. Iran ain't coming. The Iraqi Shiites have all of sort of Sunni Iraq between them and not only that, but they have all of Eastern Syria between them and the new Bin Ladenite state. So they're not coming either. They're too far. The Shiites that Bush Jr. put in power in Baghdad back in Iraq War II, they're not coming. So who's going to destroy the Bin Ladenite state? It's going to have to be the United States of America. Is going to have to go in there and go back to war against another caliphate that they built again. More, it's unreal. It's, I'm out of my mind over. I can't. I know I sound crazy explaining it, but that's just how crazy it is.
It actually explains a lot. So when will they have to do that? They'd have to be quite soon, wouldn't it? Before, yeah.
You would think, yeah. I mean, I don't. I can't even believe we're having this conversation. So Biden's just gonna whistle past the graveyard for another 7 weeks. Okay, I guess we all just accept that.
He probably doesn't even know this is happening.
Yeah, I mean, who knows what Jake Sullivan is telling him or what? Exactly, yeah. Right. Which imagine that's not even a scandal right now, ladies and gentlemen on the other side of the planet who are so far away from me, you're in danger of like falling off the bottom of it. We don't even have a president right now. Nobody even knows or cares. The world empire has no emperor, and nobody knows even who's calling.
No one's got the wheel, right? No one who's got the wheel.
That's right. That's right. There's a desk, but nobody's sitting in the chair behind it. So
the one of the fascinating observations that many people have been talking about is the way that the Syrian military literally dissolved. Mm-hmm. I think that's an accurate word. Also, the equipment that the rebels are now rebels. They were terrorists. They're rebels now. That they had seemed to be top notch. Mm-hmm. Syrian army were wearing, you know, Nikes, and these guys were in, you know, top range combat boots. Someone's been paying the wages. Who specifically would that be? Or is it everybody?
Yeah, the simple answer is Turkey and America and our NATO allies. I don't know the exact flow of money in this particular case, but I mean, I was astonished. I should stop. This is my disorder, actually, is I cannot become desensitized to this stuff, even after, you know, doing this my whole lifetime. I see headlines like this and I go, huh? So in the Kiev Post, they had a big headline boasting and bragging that their intelligence services had trained these terrorists from the HTS, as presumably as a favor to the United States, to go and use them in Syria. Now, I had just published this book, Provoked, and I had previously written a book about the war on terrorism, and then my new book is about America's Russia policy, but the war on terrorism is in the background all along, and a lot of times it's the war for terrorism, as we've seen, as we're talking about here in Syria, as it goes back and forth. But we have had numerous reports, I mean, credible reports. It sounds like crazy stuff, but we're talking solid journalism. I forget the man's name who wrote a 4 or 5 part series for The Intercept about it. And there are reports also in the New York Times about it, where yes, you literally have Bin Ladenite Islamic State, you know, ISIS type bin Ladenite terrorists from the last Syria war traveling to Ukraine to fight against Russia. Because, of course, a lot of them are Chechens. That's who went to Syria to fight against Assad. And including Albanians and Kosovars. Does this sound familiar? These are Bill Clinton's guys are coming back. The same people we backed against Russia in the 90s were then leading the jihad in Syria 10 years ago. When that went bust, a lot of them went to Ukraine because that way, in their mindset, kill Russians. That's all they care about. And America uses them as mercenaries there. And so that was why when you had that horrible attack in Moscow and Russia blamed Ukraine for sending them, regular Joes said, well, that sounds crazy. How could Ukraine be in bed with a bunch of jihadis? And I was like, well, I don't know. Yeah. Like, I don't know that Putin is right about that. Those guys could have been sent by ISIS-K in Tajikistan or by Saudi intelligence or by Barack Obama. That was a joke. I don't know exactly.
Yeah, kind of lines up, right?
But it was not outside of the realm of possibility that they actually had been contracted by Ukraine's intelligence services to go there, because there are, in fact, jihadis who have been fighting their anti-Russia jihad, continuing on all this time since 1979, mostly with American help. They've been continuing it in Ukraine, and now they're overlapping and going back and forth again on the side of the bin Ladenites in Syria.
Wow. Okay. Iran, you mentioned 79. That's a significant year.
Sure.
Iran. When did, or was that around the time that Iran became kind of like an epicenter of evil in our collective West thinking? Mm-hmm. And that was around the hostage time, Ayatollah Khomeini famously coming down the steps of the Air France jumbo and all. We remember the scenes. Mm-hmm. But is Iran really an epicenter of evil? Because we had an extended family member, he's now no longer with us, who was imprisoned in Iran under the Shah in the late 60s. He was actually tortured, and he eventually bribed his release, and that was $20,000 in $68, mm-hmm. long time ago. That was under the Shah. He was in power for 40 years, and the U.S. were good friends with the Shah then.
That's right. So, well, I'm glad you brought that up. It's a, you know, on the question of, are they the epicenter of evil? The answer is no. Is it a criminal regime? Sure. Is it a brutal authoritarian regime with an unelected supreme leader since 1989 when the last one died and he inherited the power? Yes. So not that he's his son, but he was appointed by a very small board of religious clerics. I mean, it's the most objectionable form of government I could think of. But the question, as always, is how much power do they really have to wield, right? They could be really bad in their mom's basement and we're not too concerned about it. They rule Persia. That's not nothing. But what threat do they pose to the rest of the Middle East, to the rest of the world? These are the real questions, which are, you know, the war hawks always want to assume the worst case scenario. I don't know how it is for you guys in New Zealand, but here, they had these ridiculous slogans about how Iran is the world's greatest state sponsor of terrorism.
But now we hear those lines. Yep.
Yeah. You could tell, though, that, like, well, wait a minute. Like, well, who do they sponsor? Like, you're just, it's such a slogan that it already sounds to me like you're lying. Why don't you say they're the greatest sponsor of Al-Qaeda terrorism in the world? Oh, because they're not. They're Al-Qaeda's deadly enemies and vice versa. So, but it was Al-Qaeda that knocked the towers down, not Hezbollah. I don't give a damn about Hezbollah. And in fact, the last time Hezbollah hurt America, it wasn't even really Hezbollah. It was like proto-Hezbollah killed 241 Marines or 43 Marines at the barracks in 1983 in Beirut. But guess what? Israel knew all about it and didn't warn us. So that's half points off. And by the way, so wait, let me stop. I'm rambling too much. You asked too many questions and I answered them in the wrong order. Let me go back. In 1953, the Shah had been overthrown. This was the Shah Jr., the same guy you're talking about, Shah Reza Pahlavi, the son. His father had previously been the dictator, and then he had been the dictator, and he had been thrown out, I guess, during World War II. And then after World War II, they had created a parliamentary system, and they had a parliamentary a prime minister named Mohammad Mossadegh. And he was not really a hard leftist. I don't think he was. They always exaggerate that he was just aligning with the Soviet Union, and even that he was nationalizing all Iranian oil. And I actually don't know every last particular of that, but I've heard some experts say that really he was just asking for an extra couple percent because they weren't really getting anything. And he was just asking for Iran to get a cut of the oil money at all, basically. And so they said, aha, he's a communist. And they use that as an excuse to overthrow him. So fast forward just some years, Vietnam War ends and Richard Nixon has to keep the military-industrial complex on the dole. And so one of the things he does is he pressures the Shah in Iran to increase his purchases of American weapons. So this is how Iran ended up with all those F-4s and F-14s.
Yeah, F-14. They're still flying the F-14s and F-4s.
They're still flying them to this day, both planes. So, but this helped bankrupt the country. It's a poor country, and for the poorest people, this was, you know, an outrage, the same way we feel right now when they're spending money on war, when North Carolina, people are still living in tents in the wintertime from the hurricane that hit a couple of months ago, and the national government doesn't care about them at all. And that's, you know, helped really breed a lot of resentment against the Shah. And then he was dying of cancer. So they knew that it was going to be a regime change one way or the other anyway. And the revolution broke out. And I'm so glad that you remember and mention the Ayatollah did what now? He climbed down the steps from the plane. What plane? The plane that he had taken home from Paris, France.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. He was exiled in Paris, France. Well, how did he get to Iran? Whose plane was that?
Air France. What happened
there? The answer was America told their friends, the French, to let him go home, of course. The French are our friends. They wouldn't have done that without permission. And that was because the CIA, you'll love this, the CIA and the State Department told Jimmy Carter, oh, the Ayatollah Khomeini, we like him. We know him. He helped us overthrow Mossadegh in 1953. He was part of a group that helped agitate against Mossadegh and call him a commie. And so we know him. We can work with him. And then what happened was they did send him home. He did inherit the revolution, and it was complete by February of 1979. And then what happened was for the next 10 months, America got along just fine with him. So did Israel. Got along just fine with him. Oh, he was an Islamic fundamentalist, and that's equivalent to satanic and all you need to know. Except, no, not true at all. America and Israel got along with him just fine. And in fact, America was warning him about the intentions of the new Iraqi dictator, Saddam Hussein, who had just seized power in a bloody coup the same year, right? And they were warning, hey, Saddam might do something, because Saddam was worried about his Shiite supermajority and that they might launch an Iranian a Shiite revolution, fundamentalist revolution of their own, and that he had an interest then in conscripting those Shiites and sending them to war with Iran instead. So America was warning Iran that that might happen and warning them that the Soviet Union might attack them. But then what happened was David Rockefeller, the chairman of the Chase Manhattan Bank and at that time patriarch or co-patriarch of the Rockefeller Family Enterprises, convinced Jimmy Carter to let the Shah into the United States for cancer treatment. And that was taken by the revolutionaries in Iran as a signal that we're going to nurse him back to health and then reinstall him on the throne and cancel their revolution with a counter.
Knowing the backstory, right?
Right. So that, and the backstory was the coup of 53 had been plotted from the U.S. Embassy in Tehran. So that was when the students sacked the embassy. That was in November of 79, 10 months later. And so when everyone pictures, oh, the great Satan and the burning flags and the riots and the hostages, that was after Jimmy Carter had totally blown it, not just the revolution itself, but American absolutely ham-handed foreign policy in the aftermath of that. But then this is when Jimmy Carter now looks like a jerk going into election year 1980. So in his State of the Union address, he announces the Carter Doctrine, and he says the Persian Gulf is now an American lake. And if any power, read the Soviet Union, tries to come and dominate the Persian Gulf, meaning invade Iran, America will fight them as though they're attacking the United States of America. He gave a full war guarantee to Iran that he had just lost.
Wow.
But anyway, that became the excuse then to build up all these bases in Arabia. And as part of the same doctrine, he gave the green light to Saddam Hussein to invade Iran. Because again, Saddam was afraid that his Shiite supermajority was now going to choose an alliance with Iran and their religious sect over their national and ethnic sect as Iraqis and Arabs. And they would then overwhelm him and march on Baghdad. So his motive was to conscript them all and send them to war against Iran. And that was the Iran-Iraq War, the horrific Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s.
Wow. Okay. So
you want me to keep going?
Well, I want to ask you this. The U.S. involvement in this part of the world, what are the key core interests in this part of the world
that keep,
keeps them there for decades and decades, and all this manipulation, all this playing folks off against each other? So it's oil, fundamentally.
Oil and Israel both, right?
And Israel.
Yeah, the Israel lobby has as much power and influence as the oil lobby does in Washington, and they're often at odds, but not always. You know, they compromise pretty well, work together pretty well most of the time. And America has an overall doctrine that America will be the dominant power in the Middle East, Europe, and East Asia. That way, no one else can be. And that is essentially their unassailable doctrine.
Well, that makes Israel kind of a proxy in that case for the U.S.
No,
does it work in that order, or is it the other way around?
Yeah, they always say that, but I just really cannot see the benefit of Israel to the United States. We are clearly their closest ally, but the reciprocal side of that, I mean, what, they helped, you know, pick on Nasser for us back generations ago. They help us back Al-Qaeda in Syria, but again, we're only doing that because Israel hates the Shiites more. Otherwise, what do we care? We could have made friends with Iran a long time ago. In fact, the guy who was the national security advisor for Jimmy Carter in 1979, Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was as hawkish as a center-left Democrat could get. He's sort of the Democratic Henry Kissinger. In the 1990s, I mean, again, the very man who, along with his boss, bore the humiliation of the Iranian Revolution, right? Like, it was on him. And by the 90s, he said, who cares about that, right? Like, this is business. You know what we should do? We should build a peace pipeline across Iran to export Caspian oil to the Persian Gulf. That way we have a new economic interest involved and we can start to bring Iran in from the cold. After all, the revolution and the hostage crisis and all that, that was a long time ago. Let's go ahead and get along. And the Israel lobby vetoed it. Zbigniew Brzezinski can't have his peace pipeline because Israel hates Iran more. And in fact, this is a huge part of the story of what happened in the Middle East there is, because see, after the Iran-Iraq War, we had Iraq War I, very briefly, a dispute over war debts and slant drilling over production of oil from shared oil wells. And that's America essentially encouraged Hussein to go into Kuwait, but then changed their mind when he took the whole country, is what really happened there. And so they launched Iraq War I, as everyone knows, was a short, sweet victory and rehabilitated war, cured the Vietnam syndrome and all of these things. But you probably remember that in the aftermath of Iraq War I, or maybe you don't, or your audience may or may not know, in the aftermath of Iraq War I, there was a giant but aborted and failed uprising by the Iraqi Shiites and Kurds against Saddam Hussein. And if your audience, or if you guys are familiar with the Hollywood movie Three Kings, it has Ice Cube and Marky Mark and George Clooney, and they're soldiers on a gold heist. But the setting is southern Iraq in the aftermath of Iraq War I. And all around them is the Shiite uprising, and Saddam Hussein's forces are crushing them. So that's sort of a touchstone if your audience has ever seen that gold heist movie. That's what's going on in the background there. Now, what had happened was George Bush encouraged them to rise up, but then he changed his mind because he realized that the Iraqis who had chosen Iran's side in the Iran-Iraq War, as Saddam Hussein feared, they were now coming back across the border from Iran to lead the Shiite revolution to Baghdad. So then these are the Reaganites. These are the guys who just supported Saddam in a horrific war for 9 years to contain the Iranian Revolution. Now they're the ones importing it. So they panic and they go, oh no, and they stop and then they let Saddam crush them and kill 100,000 of them to put it down. But then that became the excuse to stay in Saudi Arabia, to protect the no-fly zones, to protect the Shia and the Kurds, as though Saddam was just going to keep killing them all till they were all dead. The insurrection was over, but that became the excuse to stay. And then importantly, honestly, Bill Clinton had said, we can bring Iraq back in from the cold. They were friends of ours. He shouldn't have said anything. He should have just done it. But he telegraphed what his intentions were there. Again, you had people on both sides of the aisle who thought it was time to bring Iran back in from the cold. We're talking early 90s here. Clinton comes in 93. We can bring both these countries back in from the cold. But Israel said no. Israel insisted on a dual containment policy. They said, now that you beat Iraq up so bad in Iraq War I, they're not powerful enough to balance against Iran. So you, Americans, have to stay in Saudi Arabia to contain them both. And that dual containment policy then became the prime motivation for Al-Qaeda, which at the same time, I skipped this part, but Al-Qaeda, yeah. Which America had helped to build up to fight the war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan through those self-same 1980s, then that became their major motivation to turn against the United States of America and start attacking us because we were occupying the Holy Arabian Peninsula to bomb and blockade Iraq. And the Saudi king had said, I know you hate it, but they promised they're going to leave as soon as the war is over. But they didn't leave. They were going to stay. And that became, then once September 11th, you know, the Al-Qaeda war against America culminated in September 11th, then they went and tripled down on all of it. And what did George W. Bush do? By invading Iraq in Iraq War II in 2003, he picked up right where his father had left off when he had betrayed that Shiite revolution. And he took that Shiite revolution all the way to Baghdad, which brings us back to where we were at the beginning of the interview. Why is America backing a bunch of Sunni Al-Qaeda terrorists in Syria? To try to make up for the fact that they gave Baghdad to the Shiites. So we'll try to take Damascus away from them by giving it to Osama bin Laden's men. Brilliant, right?
If you came to me with a movie script like that, I'd say this could never happen. That's incredible to hear. October 7th, what was that, do you think? What happened there? Is what happened the superficial, what we've seen through the media version, guys arriving on paragliders that do 30 miles an hour and the most protected airspace in the world? Or is it something else?
Well, much of that is true. So there's a few different facets of this, of course, to examine it from. I appreciate you asking it broadly. I'll try to be somewhat concise. The problem is this. The people of Palestine, you know, when you call it Palestine, or you even call them Palestinians, the implication is that they're from a place called Palestine, a country called Palestine. Right? Because everybody has a country. You call them Palestinians, so like they must be from a place called Palestine. But the problem is Israel is on top of Palestine. That's why there is no Palestine. So when, I don't know how they talk about exactly in your country, but here they just lie. And they use these inapt analogies like, it would be like if Mexico was attacking across the border and now we have to defend ourselves from Mexico. But Mexico, you're implying, you mean the national government and its military are attacking us, right? But so we're not talking about Mexico. That analogy is inapt. An apt analogy would be some Indians broke out of the reservation and took some scalps in town.
Right.
But these are Indians who have already been beaten, who have already been, corralled into their pen, who have already lost their freedom and their independence. They're surrounded. They're in, you know, think of it like the most polite use of the term concentration camp, right? Mm. If you're talking about American Indians in the Gaza Strip, it's much worse. They're under total siege. They're just absolutely brutalized and blockaded. And even though this sounds too mean to be true, it makes too much sense and there's so much evidence. It's really just undeniable. We have it in their own words. I have a great article that a co-author of mine and I put together called Netanyahu's Support for Hamas Backfired. And now whenever anybody criticizes Israel, they say, oh, you love Hamas. But actually, the Likud party loves Hamas. Benjamin Netanyahu loves Hamas. And he was arming, well, not directly arming them, but he was funding them to the tune of tens, hundreds of millions of dollars. And why? It wasn't just for humanitarian aid, because he would be criticized if he didn't give some humanitarian aid to the people that he has under this horrible siege. That's not it. That's their excuse. But we have the quotes where they said over and over again what it really was. It was to prevent a two-state solution. Now, the two-state solution means that Israel would end the occupations of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and East Jerusalem and let them finally have an independent Palestinian state there, where they truly would have a country called Palestine. But in order to prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state, it makes sense for the Israelis who want that land and don't would rather have a fight over the long term, but eventually end up with that land than make peace and lose their chance for it sooner. They say we have to bolster, that's Netanyahu's words, we have to bolster Hamas in the Gaza Strip. And why? It's, Paul, for one reason. So they can say to you, Paul, we have no partner for peace. Don't you know that the Gaza Strip is ruled by Hamas terrorists? You don't expect us to give them a state, do you? But the whole thing is a sham. They're the ones who are propping them up and putting them there. Now, Israel did not create Hamas, but it's a breakoff of the Muslim Brotherhood. But they absolutely, going back into history, before Netanyahu was prime minister, in the late 80s and early 90s, it was the Shin Bet, which is like the FBI of Israel, their domestic intelligence service, along with the Mossad, who groomed and supported Hamas, gave them money, locked up all their opponents while letting them run free, supported all their charities and their religious institutions, and helped build them up. Why? Come on. Look, guys, this isn't conspiracy stuff. This is just simple politics, imperial politics, divide and conquer. The PLO is run by sort of half commie, half secularist types, half, you know, nationalist, secularist, Marxoid, weirdo guys, you know, whatever. Fine. So you build up a right-wing religious alternative, a fundamentalist Sunni imam-based political alternative to divide the Palestinians. Of course, they are Sunni Muslims, and many of them pious ones. Not that they're crazy bin Ladenite revolutionaries. They're not. But they are religious, and they believe in their religion. And so Yasser Arafat, of course, was a degenerate and a scumbag, and so were all the guys around him. They didn't believe in their religion. They believed in themselves. And so what a perfect way to divide the Palestinians from each other and themselves. They're already divided geographically. So it's a brilliant maneuver to leave Hamas ruling Gaza and the PA in the West Bank. And we have the direct quotes in that article. It'll blow your mind, the quotes I have. You know, their current finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, who is the second or the third most powerful man in the Netanyahu government right now, he said, blatantly said, and there's video of this. I mean, you can watch the video, direct translations. I got a direct translation from an Israeli-American friend of mine who speaks Hebrew and translated it for me himself. There's also all the Google machine translations and automatic video translations. You can compare and contrast and see. He says, he's ridiculing his questioner in the interview who doesn't understand. And he's saying, you have to understand, Hamas is an asset. The PA is a liability. He says, in this game of delegitimization, Hamas is an asset. They can't go to the UN. They can't go to the US. They can't go to anyone. No one cares about them. We'll listen to them. As long as it's Hamas there, all of the pressure for us to create a Palestinian state is relieved. And Ariel Sharon's advisor, Dov Weisglass, had said the same thing. He said, the purpose of the withdrawal from Gaza in 2005 and placing it under siege instead of occupying it, he said, is to put the peace process in formaldehyde. If you listen to them talk about the withdrawal, they go, well, we tried to withdraw and give them their own state, and we were rewarded with nothing but rockets. Oh, really? I don't remember the big ceremony where they got their own state. No, that's not what happened at all. What happened was Israel withdrew and turned the occupied territory into a prison camp and put the people in under total control. And then their leaders, number one advisor, explained, this is to freeze the peace process. This is to thwart it. He says, we have a certificate from the Congress that says there's no one to talk to. Get it? And then he says, you know what? As soon as the Gaza Strip is Norway, then we'll have to deal with them again. Right. So in other words, once every man in Gaza has cut off their own hands and their own ability to resist for their freedom ever again and adopted total passivity to their occupier, only then will we ever have to deal with them, because essentially we fooled the Americans by saying, look, we only have bad guys to deal with. So then now
we needed that. So then Hamas comes back and bites you, or
that's right,
or what?
Well, so Netanyahu said in that quote where he says, we must bolster Hamas, he also says, but don't worry, we control the height of the flame. Now, you could take that two ways. You could say, well, he's a pompous ass full of hubris who got bitten, right? He didn't control the height of the flame. It burned the whole kitchen down. And it's his fault for his criminal negligence and thinking he could be so clever as to play such an evil, dirty game, double game to do that. Another way to look at that, a more cynical way to look at that, and there is a lot of evidence for this. I don't think that I am going to sit here and make a conclusive case to you, but I will tell you, there have been some writers. There's one, he's got a silly pseudonym, but I don't mind saying. His name is Boltzmann Booty. That's his pseudonym. He's on Twitter. Hey, it's the 20s, man. That's how it goes. It's Boltzmann, TZ, Boltzmann Booty, and he's on Twitter and on Substack, and he has compiled a master list of heavy indications that the Israelis did know that this was going to happen. And perhaps truly in a conspiratard kind of way, really did turn a blind eye and allow the attack to take place as a pretext to kick off a major war, not just against the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, but to then turn around and take it to Lebanon and to Syria and Iran and the rest. And they had done major exercises along these lines just before, and I guess tabletop ones, but they had also had just floods of intelligence that came in of prior knowledge of what was going to happen, that they, at the very best interpretation, it was the worst case of criminal negligence and dereliction of duty in all military history, that their security forces allowed that attack to happen. Now, there are some who say, look, it was a Saturday morning, it was right after the festival, and there weren't enough people on duty, and the lines of communication were busted. Hamas was brilliant. They used drones to take out all the cameras and sensors and telecommunications equipment that had surrounded the strip. It's like Idiocracy with the automatic machine guns outside of the prison. And this kind of just, you know, like, you could really screw up over-relying on that kind of technology. You know what I mean? Like the Ho Chi Minh Trail lesson, right? Like, you can have all the sensors you want, but human men are going to outsmart them. And so, you know, there's that aspect to it. There's also the part of it that Netanyahu is a criminal. And so he had to join into a coalition with people like Bezalel Smotrich and Ben-Gavir and these other real nut jobs that he never had joined into a coalition with before. And they are determined for religious reasons, like very determined. They're not just, you know, nationalists. They are super religious nationalists on the question of occupying and really never even mind Gaza, taking the West Bank, Judea and Samaria, they call it. And they are holding the Sukkot Harvest Festival out there. And they had required the IDF to separate a detachment to go out there to protect the settlers who are, you know, squatting on Palestinian territory to do their religious ceremony and all this kind of stuff. So there's a case for the stars aligned for total negligence and dereliction of duty for this to happen. And really catch the Israelis with their pants down. And then there is an interpretation that you really don't have to be too cynical to see that they very well may have let this happen because as a pretext to start off what looks to be like a real end game towards solving their problem of dealing with Iranian power. You know, Syria was, as they always said, the keystone in the arc of Iranian power in the region. Through Syria, Iran arms Hezbollah. And now that on Netanyahu's advice, W. Bush added Baghdad to the column, they had to get rid of Assad in Damascus. And they finally did that now. And so, but I got to mention about the absolute horror show in Palestine here. October the 7th, we call it October the 7th because it happened on one day. It was over by dinner time, right? We don't even call it the second week of October 23. It was October the 7th.
Yep, one day.
And they made up all these stories. You know, they have a thing called the Hannibal Directive that says they won't allow their own people to be kidnapped, so they'll blow them away first. But that was originally invented for their own soldiers, which is bad enough. They're conscript, you know, 18-year-olds and whatever in the first place. But now, on the fly, they called it Mass Hannibal even against civilians abducted from their kibbutzes who were being taken by Hamas back into the Gaza Strip, and they blew them away. And I don't know the total numbers, but it's at least dozens of people were killed by their own government, by the IDF. But then how do you explain that this house is completely blown apart? And how do you explain that all these cars are completely destroyed like this?
Yeah,
so what they do, they embellished all these crazy stories and made it sound like ISIS when ISIS took over Iraq and threw all the gay men off the roof and this kind of thing, right? And they said that they cut a baby out of a woman's stomach and threw another baby in an oven. Both of those stories really happened in 1948 when Israeli Jews did it to Palestinians. That's really true. And they used those stories and turned them around and lied and said that Hamas had done that to them when it was a complete hoax. They said that they had killed 20 babies and cut their heads off and then hung their headless corpses from a clothesline. Totally made up. They said that they tied families together and then set them on fire, set the children on fire in front of their parents, raped and engaged in a mass campaign of rape against helpless women across. All of it was totally embellished and lied. There may have been one or two rapes, but there's no evidence that that was even by Hamas at all. Some other Palestinians also broke out of their pen that day and committed crimes, surely. But the idea that Hamas engaged in this campaign of mass rape and all this, I mean, imagine how cynical you have to be to lie about the consequences of your own dereliction of duty and embellish them so bad that the people you were sworn to protect, you now are embellishing that their children were raped and killed on your watch, just so that now you can go and kill other people's children by the tens and tens and tens of thousands. And they are just every single day. I don't know if you guys are familiar in New Zealand with the Waco massacre, when yep. Bill Clinton burned down that religious group in Waco in 1993.
David Koresh. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is my, you know, one of the important beginnings of my political education here. And I think it's just such a perfect comparison because, again, this is occupied territory. This is not the country next door. This is part of Israel, essentially. It has been de facto annexed by them since back in 67, 9 years before I was born. And they have owned it this whole time. So it's not really different than what Bill Clinton did to the Branch Davidians. Only imagine Bill Clinton doing that to the Branch Davidians and then doing it again and again and again and again for a year and 3 months in a row. That's what we're talking about. It would be like if the black gangs of South Chicago went to North Chicago and killed some white people, and then the national government, say Donald Trump, put a big wall around South Chicago and then just started bombing them and killed 60,000 of them. That's what we're talking about here. It is an absolute atrocity. It is the sickest thing in the world. And the Israeli regime is the most sadistic and criminal regime on the face of the earth. They're worse than the Chi-Coms or America.
So this is all fundamentally deep-level evil. I can't think of another word. You said cynical.
It's so wrong.
It's way more than cynical.
That's right. It's a canned hunt. It's just merciless. And the thing of it is, it's like, well, they're our friends and they speak English and they look like us and they're, you know, they claim to be part of Western civilization. So the bias all kicks in, the cognitive dissonance and the doublethink kicks in. Well, look, why would we be their friends if they were really that ruthless? But the thing of it is, you got to understand the context. And this is probably not the way most people in New Zealand think about their foreign policy. It's not the way most Americans think about their foreign policy. But there are times and places in the world where people absolutely believe they have a mandate from a holy book that says they can kill all these people and take all their property. And when you listen to Benjamin Netanyahu talk about this, he said this not just, you know, on TV to the people or like mused about it and was quoted anonymously or something. He said this in a speech to the leading officers of the IDF. He said, "The enemy are Amalek." The Bible story about a tribe that God supposedly ordered the ancient Hebrews to kill every last one of them and their children and their babies and their oxen too. And now nobody believes, nobody said or thinks really that what God came down and told Netanyahu to kill Amalek. Instead, what do we have? We have just some scumbag politician citing a 3,000-year-old Bible story and pretending that it gives him permission to kill these people who, pardon me, in fact, are not Amalek, whatever the crap that is. They are individual human men, women, and children, and elderly. And their tribe, they're not Amalek. They're descendant of the ancient Canaanites, and if you want to check the DNA, they're the ones who are descended from the ancient Hebrews. The Roman exile never happened. That's a mythology. I mean, the European Jews, sure, they're Jews too, but the people of Palestine, they are the ancient Hebrews and ancient Canaanites who just later converted to Islam. They never left. So they have just, of course they have, even if you believe in the Bible stories, they have just as much right to that land. Of course they do. But Netanyahu gets to instruct his military that the Bible says it's okay to kill their babies. Kill their babies. And then that's what they do. They target men, women, and children in their tents, in their apartment buildings, in their homes. And in the West, we are supposed to just stick our fingers in our ears and sing Mary Had a Little Lamb and pretend that we don't know this. Pretend that somehow this is them defending themselves from the terrorist enemy. When no, this is them mercilessly and brutally persecuting the Aborigines that they have locked up in a concentration camp. That's what it is. It's absolutely unreal. It's equivalent to like the Warsaw Ghetto in World War II, and the persecution of the Jews there. And there, you know, I'll leave it to some psychiatrist to talk about them acting out their social psychodramatic, pretensions and whatever. But the Palestinians didn't do the Holocaust. They don't deserve this at all. It's absolutely sick what's happening to them. It's a violation of every moral and legal foundation. You know, they invoked, everyone remembers this, is New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, Haaretz. They invoked Dresden and Tokyo and Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But Paul, we passed the Geneva Conventions after that. We don't fight war like that. That's against the law now. We have the UN Charter now, and we have the Geneva Conventions where all the nation states agreed to not fight like that anymore. What are you talking about? What do you mean Dresden? You invoke Dresden as the precedent? Talking about a city in the Third Reich, which had been the most powerful nation state in the world, which had been the aggressor in the war. Not that it justified it. Still, if you've ever read Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, it's not funny what they did to those people. It's absolutely horrific what they did to those people. But now you want to compare the Gaza Strip ghetto, which is more comparable to the Warsaw Ghetto. Now, you want to compare that to Hamburg and Dresden and Berlin to justify what you're doing to your captive population? Come on. You know, they're trying my patience with the dishonesty here on top of all the rivers of blood.
Well, here, if I was to be, I think, honest, most people see it the way it's being presented. It's no surprise to you, through their normal media go to. So they will mention all those things you've mentioned, you know, babies and microwaves and beheadings and mass rape and setting families on fire. I hear it all the time. Nope. You know, hearing what you've just said, kind of mind-blowing. I'm conscious of time. We're running out of it. And thank you for giving us so much time. We probably don't have enough time to do it justice, because I think we should flip just briefly, if we can, to Ukraine, Russia. Where does Russia... Is Russia connected? Are these things all interconnected, I guess?
Sure.
Is the question?
Yeah, it's essentially one big story about what happened. What did America do after the last Cold War? Right? We could have come home, but instead we did not. And so H.W. Bush, the same guy who said America will remain the dominant power in the Middle East, is the same guy who said America will remain the dominant power in Europe. And not only will we remain the dominant power there, we will steadily incorporate all of the Eastern European states into our military alliance, all of them, except, of course, Russia, because Russia's too big and too powerful. And so if they were inside of our security alliance or partnership, they would have too much of a say in our policy. You know, it keeps coming up about Versailles. Now, the lesson of the treaty that ended the First World War was that that was really bad, and we shouldn't have done that. Because Wilson intervened in that war, he helped Britain and France crush Germany and force them to sign this horrible treaty where they lost all these territories and agreed to these horrible reparations. And as everyone knows, this helped lead to the rise of the Nazi Party to try to, adjust for that, get vengeance and take those territories back. So I was raised on this, that after World War II, America, now being the dominant power, not France and Britain, said, we'll handle this. And for West Germany and for Japan, we rebuilt them and befriended them so that they wouldn't just be our enemy again. We didn't conquer them and colonize them. We just made them our friends. But we kind of did colonize them, right? America still militarily occupies Germany and Japan and pwn completely their foreign policy. When the Soviet Union fell apart, well, that was nice and everything, but America never got to truly occupy the Russian Federation, take over their governments, decommunize their bureaucracy, and make the thing so much a vassal state like Germany and Japan that they would be able to accept working with it, because working with it means they do what we say, right? Instead, we're left with a rump Soviet empire, right, in the Russian Federation, not that they're commie anymore, who are too big to share power with. So as we expand our influence into Eastern Europe, it is necessarily at their expense and with them as the object. The policy went from containment to friendship to neo-containment very quickly, way back in the 1990s. And as all of the guys who did it warned, this is going to cause a real problem with Russia, and especially when it came to the question of Ukraine, that this is such an important country to Russia, and yet so many Ukrainians want, especially in the west of the country, want out from under Russia's thumb, that the way we handle this is very precarious. What we should do, some people propose just splitting the country, like the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Why not? Others said, well, at least in terms of foreign policy, what we can do is we can, sign a treaty that gives them permanent neutrality, like Austria had during the last Cold War, where Austria was neither East nor West, neither Warsaw Pact nor NATO, had no occupying troops, weren't commie. They were capitalist, but they weren't avowedly with the West, and certainly were not avowedly anti-Soviet. And so they were able to keep their independence throughout the Cold War. And so the idea was, and Finland was the same way. And so then the idea was, well, that's what we'll do for Ukraine. We'll have a permanent Finland-Austria neutrality policy for Ukraine so that us and Russia don't have to fight about it. But then they never did that. And so when it came down to it, they did try to take Ukraine away from Russia, and it did end up blowing up into the catastrophe that we have here. That's the long and the short of it. There's the color-coded revolutions and missile defense and other interventions, the Serbian wars in the Balkans in the 1990s and the rest. But and also importantly, as we talk about the war on terrorism here, again, America backed the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Soviet Union. It helped break the back of the Soviet Union in the 1980s. But that wasn't just the Afghan Mujahideen. That was the Arab Afghan army of international terrorists from all over the place that went there to fight. And then Bill Clinton helped with Saudi and Britain, of course, to send these guys straight to Bosnia. Straight to Chechnya and straight to Bosnia, where they started those wars. And, I guess America really backed them in Chechnya later, but certainly backed them in Bosnia and then Kosovo and in Chechnya. And at the same time, they were already attacking us. They had attacked us in Yemen, in Saudi Arabia, at the World Trade Center the first time in 93, the Africa embassies, the USS Cole. So this whole time that they're attacking us, Bill Clinton and his government still think they're clever using these Mujahideen where? Against the Russians in Chechnya and against the Russians' friends, the Serbs, in the former Yugoslavia. And in fact, as I demonstrate in the book, more than half of the September 11th hijackers had fought in Bosnia or Chechnya or both. And these were the very same men who then turned around and hit the United States of America. And I know a lot of people just think the CIA did it. I really don't. In fact, there's a former FBI bin Laden hunter named Ali Soufan who talked about how the Chechens complained to bin Laden, "Why are you targeting America? They've been so good to us. They helped us in Afghanistan and Bosnia and Kosovo. Now they're helping us here in Chechnya. Why do you want to attack them?" And it was because they didn't understand his vision was about getting, first of all, revenge for America occupying Saudi Arabia to bomb and blockade Iraq and supporting Israel in their merciless persecution of the Palestinians, but also that he had a plan to lure us into war in Afghanistan, to bog us down and bleed us to bankruptcy and replicate the same war that we had helped him do to the Soviets back in the 80s against us, which is exactly what happened, of course.
Yeah. So this is all about fundamentally what maintaining an enemy somewhere. You've got to have an enemy, and only a few come into that potential because they have to be of, like you said, Russia, certain size, power, resources, mm-hmm. population. There are some that you're not going to be able to walk into, as the Germans mm-hmm. found out. But there are all these others, you know. But you use them to always be going at the main target, with which is Russia. And I assume that is to keep the complex going, or
that's a big part of it.
Yeah.
And look, I mean, you know, a lot of times the realists are so much less worse than the neocons that we really forget, like, how brutal and amoral they are, too. Right. Mm. So, like, if you think about it, and oh, forget all these neoconservative revolutionary nostrums and stuff, just in terms of brute power politics. Well, it's in our interest to support this revolution against this dictator who doesn't do what we say. Mm. Now, it's not in our interest to do that. Right. Most of the time. But from their eyes, in the short term, in a bureaucrat's time frame in power, it might be in his interest to support doing something like that. When it's the kind of thing that, you know, really redounds negatively for everybody else. And also, you do have so much stupidity built into the thing, too, where, like, for example, it was Netanyahu's guys who were so sure that if, and including him, that if we got rid of Saddam, that would give America and our allies so much dominance over the Iraqi Shia, they'd be able to lord it over Iran, over Hezbollah, over Syria, and everybody else, and make the world safe for Israel. And this is just complete harebrained nonsense, right? That was not how it worked at all. They put their regional rivals in power in Baghdad. They've been trying to make up for it by backing suicide bombers on the bin Ladenite side ever since then. But that's just like with all government programs too, right? Like, this is the economics of government programs, is usually their incentive in the first place is to make matters worse. But then oftentimes, because they lack the profit and loss test, and they always have, especially when you're talking about overseas missions, they always fail the knowledge test too, about who really we should be backing and who's going to represent our interests in the long term and whatever. They essentially cannot help but fail. And so this is why the GIs in Vietnam, they call the army the self-licking ice cream cone, because everywhere it goes, it causes a problem and then gives itself something new to do. But, like, isn't that the same with the Department of Education? And isn't that the same with the central bank that causes inflation and the boom and bust cycle and then says, oh, no, we have to fine tune everything so we can get employment just right, when they're the ones who just unemployed everybody?
That's right.
And same thing with all of the rest of this, right? They're the ones who cause the problems, and then they're the ones who swoop in to save us. Oh, the great Harry Brown, the American libertarian of a previous generation, he said the government, you know, what they're really expert as is they break your leg and then they hand you some crutches. And they say, if it wasn't for us, you wouldn't be able to walk at all.
Yeah. Maybe that's a good note to finish on. It's been a fascinating conversation. And there's so much more, but, you know, maybe for another day. Scott Horton, editor, antiwar.com. We'll list out all the other points of contact with the replay links that we will put with the replay. This has been on our live show, though. Thanks for coming on. Really interesting to chat with you. And the extent of this, the size of this is way more to me now than before I talked with you, I got to say.
I'm very happy to hear that. And I don't even mind. I'll pay the shipping. Give me your mailing address and I'll send you some books there to New Zealand.
Oh, that'd be great.
And you guys be careful down there. Don't you fall off the bottom of the world now.
We're hanging on. All right.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. And have a great holiday, Christmas, New Year, etc. Thank you.
You too.